The Broken Clock Podcast is back for another episode, and this week we are talking about sophistry. Now, there's two general buckets of what sophist thinking is. One is an ancient Greek school of philosophy that essentially lost the battle of ideas to Aristotle and Plato. Another is a term for the use of fallacious arguments, especially with the intention of deceiving. Now, Mouse, I'm gonna suggest that the term sophistry has actually changed because so many people now use fallacious arguments just because they've heard them somewhere else. They don't necessarily intend to deceive. They've lost all concept of deception. And I think that might actually be more in keeping with what the original sophists did. So I'm starting that with a hot take. What do you think of that?
Well, so the original sophists were at largely itinerant teachers mm-hmm. who were paid to often educate a young nobleman in terms of rhetoric, athletics. They usually wielded several areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. They were far more concerned with practical arguments than with philosophical examination. So of course, Plato was not very keen on them. Mm-hmm. He considered that teaching, exchanging knowledge for money was debasing, the enterprise of knowledge. Of course, you would have had to ask Plato, but of course he's dead, so we can't.
Right.
How exactly was a teacher supposed to make a living?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, just because Plato was a great philosopher doesn't mean he was right about everything.
Well, he wasn't as great as people think he is, but
he was first. He was a first. He said a lot of things first that we're aware of. But they weren't wrong that the sophists did. They seemed to be more interested in winning arguments than actually being right.
Right. They focused a lot on the uses of rhetoric.
Right.
Which is, it's interesting because, of course, Aristotle was a very, very staunch critic of the sophists, even though some people would have said that because he was a mentor to Alexander the not so great, mm-hmm. he would have been classified as a sophist himself. However, there is an apocryphal story that we don't quite know if it's true or not, but supposedly Aristotle did not ask Philippus for payment and money, but instead for the education of his son, Aristotle requested that Philippus rebuild Aristotle's hometown, which Philippus had destroyed in one of his many, 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 many military campaigns. I have not been able to verify if this is true or not, but it's still a payment.
Yeah, and well, one would argue that's reparations, not a payment,
yeah.
But still it is an exchange of a thing of value for a service.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, yes, that is an element of sophistry, the idea that it's different when it's not. The problem
which is interesting because some of that has crept into art. You know, the whole notion that art becomes somewhat less pure when you charge money for it. And in fact, I used to know a teacher over at the Denver School of Design who told his students, and of course, many of them brainlessly repeated it,
yeah.
That the more commercially available a piece of art became, the less valuable and therefore the less artistic it became. So, for example, the Mona Lisa, La Gioconda, as its name, is inherently much less valuable because anyone can own a print of it. And so, of course, I had to restrain myself not to smack this person. You know how I am.
Yeah.
I told him he was a fool and I decided to go and eat somewhere else.
Well, that was restrained for you, but you weren't wrong. You weren't wrong. The argument is inherently fallacious. I mean, this gets into the idea of who gets to determine what good art is. You know, that's sort of a subjective thing outside of, you know,
art has become the modern art world has become the realm in many ways of sophistry, because art experts, for example, art experts, and this is something that this is something that filled me with glee. They did a little test, as inconvenient scientists are wont to do. Mm-hmm. And they gathered a whole bunch of self-proclaimed, people who were hailed as mm-hmm. great art experts in the field. And these people could not tell apart the so-called artistic photography of individuals and passport photos.
Yep.
And the conclusion, and I wish I did not have the forethought to prepare a link to the study, but it can be easily Googled.
It's in my show Boss Fight, episode 4. I referenced this study. So yeah. Yeah. And, it's a beautiful, beautiful study because it just sort of shows that mm-hmm. art critics, what they determined is that professional art critics were more likely to just basically continue to prop up the idea of, you know, things that were previously deemed prestigious instead of judging art on its own merits on a paradigm of beauty.
Mm-hmm. And so you have there, it's anyone who can convince you that something is prestigious is, regardless of whether or not it's just a goddamn dot on a white canvas,
yeah.
is an exercise in sophistry.
Right, as is the entire is it art argument, right? Mm-hmm. I remember in university we studied the bicycle wheel, you know, the whole thing. It was just a bicycle wheel on a stool. Is it art? And the professor waxed on poetically about the whole is it art debate. And I remember sitting here thinking, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, who cares? Why? But, you know, little did I know at the age of like 18 years old that naming things has made a number of academic careers. That seems to be how you get a name for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it be Ben Shapiro or Ibram X. Kendi. I know this is fighting words to compare those two, but, you know, both of them, Robin DiAngelo, they're all sort of known because they coin terms. They say things that get people either repeating them or fighting with them. And to me, being considered smart because you named something is the height of sophistry. Is it a new idea, or is it an old or an improved idea, or is it just an existing idea relabeled, right? I mean, that drives me nuts. And I paused to cough. I muted my mic. I was a good girl. So, in trying to find examples of sophistry in you know, the modern discourse, modern media, I actually struggled to find more examples of things that weren't sophistry.
Oh yeah,
modern media.
We exist in a very sophistical society at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the art of persuasion seems to be indistinguishable from the art of deception. And it just seems to be that nobody terribly cares about being right anymore. More often than not, people are more interested in flying tribal flags of some kind. It's more important to be consistent than to be right.
Well, there is a reason for that. Whether consciously or not, a lot of people realize that in many cases, they don't stand a chance of being able to make a persuasive, rational argument.
Huh.
In many cases, there's a reason why a lot of people get absolutely furious when you start Socratizing at them.
Well,
and
yeah.
Actually, when you start taking apart the things that they say, showing the internal contradictions, because in many cases I have discovered it's not that they are unaware of these internal contradictions.
Yeah.
It's because this is the best way they know how to make an argument, because in one way or another, they are admitting that they are incapable of making a rational argument, that they don't know right. how to make a rational argument. And of course, with this is also bundled up with a little bit of solipsistic nonsense. It is a notion that if they can't make a good argument for the thing which they champion,
oh, interesting. Okay.
There is no, then there must be no rational argument for the thing which they champion.
That's interesting. To me, it comes from a place of if we have this idea, this false idea of perfection in our society, get 100%, right? Instead of recognizing that that was 100% on that very subjective test marked by that very subjective supervisor, that there's this possibility of perfection. And in order to have any sort of value in our very hyper competitive environment, you have to be perfect. Any less than that, you know, you're either number one or you're nothing, right? Oops. And so admission that one was wrong means a person has absolutely no value whatsoever. A person's value is totally situational and subjective, just because the audience in a given situation decides that they're right, which is basically what the sophists developed their argument to do, right? Like, that was their job, to prepare young, noble men for the essentially the political arena, to teach them to talk good, not think well, not think rationally, just convince people, right? Whether they were right or they're wrong. The sophistic school has no interest in being right. It, you know, it's about being popular. It's about being accepted. And so you get gems like this quote from Pythagoras, a human being is the measure of all things, of those things that are, that they are, and of those things that are not, that they are not. It's a meaningless phrase, but a lot of people just go, well, yeah, that's true. A person is a measure of all the things they are and all the things that they are not. What does that mean? That means friggin' nothing. It's a platitude. But because no one can find anything tangible about it, they can't really argue it, right? And that's pretty much all of modern discourse, my lived experience.
Well, regarding what I was, the reason I was saying what I was saying, mm-hmm. Is that, for example, this is something I have noticed. Let's talk about some of the arguments that people have on minimum wage. I think that a lot of the arguments that they're making are flawed. Now, one way or another, one of the things that they have, that I have noticed, is that when, for example, you show, let's say, I have seen this happen, when you show, you know, the arguments for minimum wage that you're making are not the good ones. For example, it is shown in certain levels that this actually does not help people, because inflation is still a thing. And so regardless of what, you know, the arguments that you're making, the minimum wage laws do not actually address the issue that is causing people's money to be worth less, that is causing a lot of people to not be able to afford a living, because you raise the minimum wage, but what'll happen is it'll stagnate for the next 5 years, and you still have the government printing money like it's
right.
DC Comics. You've got the Federal Reserve playing with people's futures and making questionable policies that end up devaluing your money more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, when you say these arguments do not actually help people. It does not create the effect that you intended.
And yeah.
9 times out of 10, people respond, well, it might actually work. It might not work, but it's the right thing to do. And that's the moment you go, oh, okay, there's sophistry.
That right it, there. It is, because if it doesn't help people, it doesn't actually have a moral justification.
Right. And if you're actually interested in having a rational argument, you can say, okay, that these parameters, it might not actually help this, these parameters. Let me do some research and see if there is something that the minimum wage actually does help with.
Right. I mean, we had success with the minimum wage up here, but of course, then there's the issue of livability, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage and the train of thought is chiming in right now. But I mean, raising the minimum wage outside of Toronto, where I live, you see people being able to get by, you know, being an essential worker at the local grocery store. Shout out to my girl, Margaret. She keeps that place running. There's this one lady at the grocery, one of the grocery stores we go to. I live in the farmer's market capital of Ontario. So the grocery stores are epic. You want to see functioning capitalism, check out the grocery store wars where I live. It is marvelous. But there's this one lady, Margaret, and she's just so, she's kind of odd, but she's lovely. But you can tell that the people who work at that store, they're not wallowing in misery the way people who work in a similar job closer to Toronto or in Toronto themselves, because, you know, it's the difference between being able to own like a little house or an apartment, you know, and live on your own and do okay. Or, you know, you're in a downtown condo that's, you know, 1,000 square feet between four adults, because that's what you can afford. Right. And I noticed that a lot of people, I mean, it's the same thing with healthcare, right? I remember The Economist did an excellent thing during the Obama-McCain election, where they showed that, you know, Obama's plan intended to increase coverage, McCain's plan intended to control costs. The truth is, in order to improve U.S. healthcare, you had to do both. And the ideal solution was to merge their two plans. Now, some of that did kind of happen, but because, you know, political obstructionism is what it is, they didn't take the best argument. They didn't work together. They stood on ceremony and argued this false morality that, Mouse, you're identifying, because that ups enthusiasm when something is simple and easy to understand. People will follow you off that cliff, even though you're probably wrong. And then people get disillusioned and say all politicians are the same. That's a bit of sophistry too. No, all politicians are objectively not the same. You know, you can't compare somebody like Claire McCaskill, who went down swinging because she refused to, you know, vote against, I think it was an abortion bill that she refused to, she defied the will of her constituents to do what was right and to uphold the values that she, you know, said she was for when they elected her, compared to somebody like, say, Ted Cruz. If Ted Cruz said the sun had risen this morning, it probably would have been the day of an eclipse. Right? Like, I'd have to check. That dude he's an unsophisticated sophist, but he is very much a sophist. He says things that if you knew absolutely nothing about Ted Cruz and the world would seem to make so much sense, but it's completely fallacious. And in his case, I think he knows it.
Oh, yes.
He just does it so often that it isn't like, you know, a Maxine Waters, who, she's an older lady. She gets, you know, whipped up sometimes. Nancy Pelosi's getting on in years. They sometimes say things not recognizing how they're going to land. But to lump somebody like a, you know, a Maxine Waters or a Nancy Pelosi in the same boat as a Ted Cruz or a Josh Hawley, that's completely fallacious. It's popular, you know, you'll get everybody nodding in a room full of people who really don't want to talk about politics. So it's like a pox on both your houses, right? But it's not actually accurate. And Mouse, you made a comment about persuasive arguments and rational arguments. And unfortunately, I'm starting to think that the rational argument is no longer the persuasive one, because rational arguments are inherently logical. And right now, we live in an age where people need their emotions validated, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's real. And I think the goal is to validate emotions without being a sophist, without manipulating people. And I struggle with that, because there's a big difference between acknowledging someone's emotions and validating them and appealing exclusively to those emotions to push a fallacious argument, right? It is a real art. It's very difficult. I would argue it's nigh impossible in this day and age, say, I understand how you feel. I get how you feel. Your feelings are valid. Here's why I still think this isn't the way to go, right? That automatically people are like, you're ignoring me. No, I can repeat accurately what your position is. I'm not ignoring you. I'm not dismissing you. I just disagree. That has been lost, because you know what? I'm not quite sure why. I have my theories. I think that all this crowdsourcing, crowd housing, crowdfunding, what do they call work space sharing, communal workplaces, you know, the Google effect, where everything's mm-hmm. just a big open room where people flop someone and they don't have their own space. People are just going along to get along, and it's made us a society of sophists, right? You just say what's going to keep you out of trouble instead of thinking about something and going, hold up, wait, I actually think there's a better way to go about this, right?
There's also another element to this, and it is that we have, and this is a nod to Sir Terry Pratchett, we have forgotten the place of stories. Mm-hmm. We have forgotten to see, Terry Pratchett was fascinated by stories and how much they seem to repeat mm-hmm. and how much they seem to want to repeat themselves. So much so that in his books, he examined the question of story as, in his universe, by saying that stories were essentially wrapped coils of space-time mm-hmm. floating throughout the universe, and that they sought to be told. And so they would attach themselves to people. They would shape things. They would shape events so that the story could get told. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, him using it as a metaphor for how we tend to operate. As a species, we are storytellers. We like telling stories. And that is perfectly fine. A story is a great way to package information, to package a point. The problem is that at some point, and we've done this at several points in our history, we have forgotten that stories are not real. In the sense that life does not have a narrative. People's lives are messy. Sure. Even though we might want to look at, you know, we look at the lives of Beethoven or Abraham Lincoln, and we try to use frameworks to highlight certain running themes, etc. At the end of the day, most lives are chaotic. The world in and of itself is chaos, in the notion that, in the concept that chaos means something that you cannot easily predict. So in many ways, we tell ourselves stories to find comfort, to make sense of things. The problem happens when stories come, move out of that space of coping mechanisms, entertainment, etc. Mm-hmm. And we want to make stories real. We want to enforce that. Now, the villain, actually, of that book where I was talking about is someone who wants to force people to live the stories that they think they need, that they think are best for everybody else.
Right.
And so, of course, Sir Terry created a character in this villain, and I'm not going to say who the villain is. You guys need to go and read it. The book is called Witches Abroad, and I think it's a masterpiece of a book. But in that book, he created a sophist. This person was not concerned with how things were. This person was concerned with how she wanted things to be.
Right.
How she wanted what the story had to be. And so she would force people and convince people in order to get her, to get them onto this railroaded story.
Right.
And of course, and here's the interesting part. And this is something that a lot of people miss because they go, well, yeah, it's fantasy, you know, witches, magic, whatever. But a lot of Terry Pratchett's, actually the great majority of Terry Pratchett's storytelling uses fantasy to kind of
talk about things that piss him off.
We'll talk about things that piss him off. Yeah. But so this character used stories to grow more powerful.
Right.
The more stories that got told, the more stories that she manipulated into being told, the more powerful she grew. And in the end, it's a sophist. It's a modern day sophist politician.
Yeah.
And so because we exist at this point in an age of rhetoric where the appearance of things and the story that is being told is far more important than the facts that underline the events, you know, now we have alternative facts.
Right.
So that tells you how far up rhetoric's ass we are in this point.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. Rhetoric shouldn't lead the facts. Facts must lead rhetoric.
And so, you know, Aristotle saw the danger of this. This is why on rhetoric, he talked about the different kinds of rhetoric, how you had the emotional appeal, how you had the logical argument. And he warned that over-reliance on emotional appeal would lead you off the rails. Because, of course, he equated that argument with the kind of thing that the classical sophists were doing, which was to craft an argument that was pleasing enough to the mass, regardless of the soundness of the argument, of the argument's internal structure, of the facts supporting that argument.
Well, I mean, Aristotle was also watching Athens create cancel culture.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason he was really big on facts versus rhetoric, because stakes were so high that not, you know, adequately appealing to the mob got you kicked out, got you stripped of your citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Athenians can be credited with creating cancel culture. They invented the idea of ostracism.
Yes.
But I mean, I think another example of a sophist in fiction is Thanos.
Yes.
You know, now Marvel itself, its universe is sophistic in this case, not sophisticated, but sophistic in that, you know, they create an artificial crisis. What is it? The Malthusian
cliff,
the Malthusian paradox. And it's amazing.
Okay, before you go on this, okay. I want you know how they're doing all these prequel series and posts and, you know, sequel series. I want a mini series of Thanos going to his liberal arts college where he runs into the Malthusian argument, and I want like three episodes of him just discussing Malthusianism with all of his friends, and they all get bored of him and go to hell already, and nobody's hanging out with him, which is why he ends up going wanting to destroy half the galaxy.
Well, what's fascinating about Falcon and Winter Soldier, which I highly recommend to everybody, it's so good just as a piece of spectacle, but there's a really great Captain America style speech about that kind of thinking. And he actually references the insane god, which of course, before Thanos became something people quote in memes on the internet, oh god. He was known as the Mad God.
Mad Titan. And the Mad, the Titan. Mad
Titan. The Mad Titan. Yeah, they didn't call them gods. They called them Titans because Jack Kirby was smart. but, I mean, Titan is way cooler than God. Let's face it. It's a completely different concept. But, you know, the original Thanos stories, he's crazy. He's in love with death. That's why he's doing the things he's doing. I could buy that. Like, okay, I'm on board. Take me for the ride. Right? Instead, they decided Thanos had to make sense. I think because Joss Whedon himself is a sophist. Was, I talk about him like he doesn't exist anymore, but he is a sophist. He jumps through hoops, justifying his own poor behavior using things that sound very, you know, reasonable, but they're just, you know, you sit on a throne of lies, Joss Whedon. You sit on a throne of lies. But you know, the central issue of the Thanos problem is that he can manipulate matter, just create more resources, you know, and people who have studied the sophistry of the Marvel Cinematic Universe insist you can't. That violates a rule of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where apparently, instead of, you know, it a conservation of mass, you can destroy things but not create things, even though Thanos created plenty of things on screen. Apparently you cannot create more resources, and I'm
if you have the reality stone, you can rewrite reality.
Well, that's the thing. Like, okay, you're not creating mass in the universe, you're just taking, say for instance, a whole bunch of space junk, rearranging its anatomical composition to make food. P.S. Why the fuck do we all care? That's the one thing I was really happy about in WandaVision. Disney just took all that pseudoscience, the Marvel Universe, and went, hey, guess what? The Infinity Stones are actually just magic pieces, because Disney likes magic, right? because magic.
I saw my baby.
Yeah, like I'm a terrible, I love space opera and I love fantasy. I am a terrible consumer of science fiction, because the minute anybody tries to explain to me how something works, I immediately start channeling my late stepfather and going, that's bloody nonsense. I would rather somebody just go, because magic, than spend, you know, an entire fictional manual explaining to me how dilithium crystals work, right? That's just my own personal preference. Other people are better at suspending disbelief the minute you get into the realm of science fiction. And to me, magic is just science unexplained. So, I mean, let's face it, potions are chemistry, and some of the other things people did, it's just like, hey, it was science that they didn't call science, because don't let the church hear you. it is a metaphor, and I think I wish Terry Pratchett was better known.
I know.
I think that the way Terry Pratchett used, because I mean, Terry Pratchett's heroes, many of them are women, but they're flawed people. And it's really more like, you know, like you said, the villains in Terry Pratchett novels tend to just be very self-deluded, whereas the heroes, as flawed as they are, as cantankerous as they are, as ditzy as they are sometimes, are actually
McGrath.
Truth. Yeah. Yeah. They're actually interested in truth. And that's what distinguishes a Terry Pratchett hero from a Terry Pratchett villain. I'm being a bit reductive here, but that's a major element of Terry Pratchett's work that I think is very important. Now, you know, you get to this idea of alternative facts, right? I'm going to argue that alternative facts and lived experience are sometimes the same thing.
Yeah.
My husband was talking about this thing he read online about Broadway performers denouncing racism. And people started talking about their lived experiences. And one woman who's Black insisted that a Broadway producer committed racism against her because she was the understudy for a character and they wanted her hair to look a certain part for the character. Mm-hmm. And after a bunch of back and forth, her saying, I don't want to straighten my hair. I want to use my natural hair. The producer said, fine. We're not fooling anyone. And she considered that racist. And I'm like, but that's the thing about understudies. When someone's understudying, you're never fooling anybody that, you're getting the lead. That's why those tickets are cheaper. Mm-hmm. But if we're to use, and ironically, Mouse, critical theory, at least deconstructionism, Derrida, owes a lot to the sophist movement. Derrida was heavily influenced by the sophists.
Color me surprised.
Yeah. and I mean, I think there is wisdom in hearing another perspective, right? I'm not totally poo-pooing lived experience. It's lived experience or alternative facts is not, it's not 100% protection against questions. Mm-hmm. Because everybody may just shut their mouth on that woman who insisted we're not fooling anybody is racist. But it could be a lot of other things. And why do you want to go there? Well, it could be a lot of reasons, and I don't care to speculate. The problem is, if you're wrong, if you like cry wolf, you become significantly less persuasive going forward. And this is something I struggle with in terms of, talking about certain things in public. There's this whole conspiracy theory coming up about me. You want to talk about sophistry here, that there is a Twitter Leanna. And Twitter Leanna is extremely different than any other media Leanna. These people postulate that I am a completely different person on Twitter because they're comparing. Yeah. They're comparing how I make an argument in 240 characters to how I make an argument in a half hour YouTube video or, a 1 hour podcast. If we make our podcast only an hour, instead of recognizing that, no, the format Twitter is an inherently brief format. Right. Mm-hmm. Even if you do a tweet chain of, I forget what the limit is, but you have to keep your individual pieces of thought short. Instead of just accepting Twitter for what it is and reading people's thoughts informed by the medium and the fact that they have to keep it short, which means it's a whole bunch of like heuristics and incomplete thoughts. No. I become a completely different person on Twitter. Now, also...
You spin around, there's a flash of light, and there's Twitter Leanna.
Yeah, it makes no sense, right? It is not even the most likely outcome. But people have become utterly convinced of this. Of course, this is all tied up in the whole Lindsay Ellis thing that I talked about last week.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. It's incredible how that kind of corner of the internet, I'm learning so much about this corner of the internet.
The pool corner.
Well, it is the corner of the internet that is very impressed with, they're one of these credentialist people who they humble brag their spot on the New York Times bestseller list, only seven on the New York Times bestseller list. Oh. They drop, unless it's like Harvard, Yale, Stanford, I'm not super up on what the prestigious US schools are, but somebody told me there's a school in New York that is super prestigious for certain things. But they think that because they have education of a certain pedigree, they can argue blue is red and make it stick. And the problem is,
some people have tried to do that with the Greeks.
Well, that's sophistry, right? I mean, that's the core of it. And the problem is that you've got, and it is like a college phenomenon, right? Because blue collar people have to exist in a world where they don't get to argue blue is red, right? Mm-hmm. They have to accept blue is blue and red is red. Why? Because if they don't, they get fired. But these people who just are so impressed with their words, you know, education, they're probably still paying off, which is why they have to make it seem like it has a ton of value. They think that if they just use enough words and the words are clever enough, blue becomes red because. And to me, it just ends up looking like...
Don't do that to me.
Well...
you know what happened?
What?
Because
of the wonderful things he does. Yeah. We're off to see the office. Yeah. okay. That was accidental on my part. I avoided a Wicked reference, so we didn't start singing there, but I landed in this one.
Yeah.
It happens. I musicaled. We did reference Broadway, but that was...
Yes, we did.
But it is just... It's like... certain groups of people, it's not a single group, because there are actually pockets of this. They think that if they just agree upon certain delusions, those delusions come true. It's like the bizarro evil version of what Terry Pratchett was saying about stories. Now, of course, where Terry Pratchett is right and they are wrong is that the good guys believe in truth in Pratchett. And they don't. They just believe in appeals to popularity, appeals to the mob.
Well, there's one of my favorite moments in a Terry Pratchett book is when Magrat is interested in truth. She just she's a young witch, very, very young. She's read a lot of books, and she has a lot of funny ideas about what witchcraft is. So she has very romantic ideas. She's not a liar. But she sometimes, she is prone to fall for the romanticized version of things.
Oh, so that might be worse.
In one moment, they're going to do a spell, and Magrat says, you can't do that. You need the magic sword, and you need incense, and all of that stuff. And then, of course, Nanny Ogg says to, you know, she's been reading books again. And she, you know, when there were points in witchcraft when you had to hide who you were long time ago, so witches learned to do with whatever they needed. So they used, like, soap flakes instead of incense, etc. But... Mm-hmm. But Magrat is constantly being deluded by those things. And at one point, Granny Weatherwax turns to Magrat and says, there's three things that you need to learn in order to be a real witch, Magrat Garlic. What's real, what's not, and what's the difference? The difference,
yep. Now, of course, you know, people schooled in existentialism and deconstructionism, we can't perceive what is real. It is all our perception. It's like, that's nice, you know, but no, there are things that are more real than other things, right? I think people argue that perception theory, that existentialist theory, just so that they don't have to actually take a stand about something, because the minute you take a stand, somebody may not like you. Mm-hmm. And then we go back to that whole ostracism thing and the fact that, you know, the sophists were basically trying to insulate young men against ostracism. That's probably the kindest description of them and their utility. One could argue they were also trying to consolidate power. But we're possibly the original grifters, though I'm sure that predates ancient Greece.
Yeah.
But you know, they were, and this is what sophistry does. It does insulate people the way, you know, the certain parts, mostly on the right, but increasingly among the left as well, is that, you know, any attempt to say this is not acceptable behavior is cancel culture and therefore anti-freedom. Right? That's the panacea they're attempting to float right now, because they cannot find a way to demonize Joe Biden, so they've retreated to Dr. Seuss.
Which of course, you know, is kind of hilarious coming from the political party that decided that an entire population of people was not acceptable behavior, and therefore they could not get married, which is kind of like cancel culture.
Well, there's also the fact that a lot of them are saying the things they say because they don't want to get primaried by somebody even more extreme than them, who is better at licking Trump's boots.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. It's absurd on its face, but it seems to people who are very afraid of cancel culture coming for them that these are good people to get behind. Yes, I don't want this happening to me, so this is reasonable. But here's the thing. The issue with cancel culture is not that there is anything that is deemed unacceptable by society. You know, that's the irony. These people want to label Black Lives Matter some sort of terrorist organization. But cancel culture, right? Heaven forbid scary Black people go out and protest, mostly peacefully. It's the problem with cancel culture is the arbitrary shifting line of what is considered acceptable and not acceptable. We used to call it Orwellian, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's so ironic to me about this whole cancel culture thing is talk about stories, right? Cancellation was just something I first saw it on Black Twitter, was just a way to name something that's already happening, right? It was a descriptor. It was not intended to be a philosophy. And the wonderful sophist element of cancel culture is that nobody can agree on what it is. And that makes it a wonderful tool of sophistry, because if you can't define something clearly, nobody can tell you you're wrong or not being internally consistent or logical. These constructs, like that quote I read about people are what they are and aren't what they aren't. Like, what? What does that mean? I mean, that was more of a Yogi Berra-ism, and those it actually kind of have is. Some with like Yogi Berra is the anti-sophist, right? You know, when he says it's so busy, nobody goes there anymore, you know what he means.
Yes.
But, you know, Yogi, those were turns of phrase. Those were nudge and a wink. Those were not intended to sort of be anything but glib and fun. And again, create a sort of structure for life. Right.
Right. They were epigrammatical.
Right.
Remarks.
Right. Creating a structure for life. And this to me is the difference between stories and propaganda. Creating a structure is like, through stories, is like a path, right? You're creating more sort of a well-trodden, more stable path so that journeying through life is easier, right? Right. That is much different than a cage.
Uh-huh.
And that is what is happening with this descent into sophistry, this descent into rhetoric. And that cage is what people call cancel culture. People feel so restrained, so caged in what they can express, that I think not only, you know, do they walk around being afraid all the time of saying the wrong thing, but their inner thoughts actually become more extreme, more angry, less productive, precisely because they're feeling so suppressed, right? Yeah. And that's the difference between a story that Terry Pratchett was talking about. And this, you know, the Pratchett story, as opposed to what George Orwell called, you know, double think, good think, that kind of thing. And, you know, that is the problem with a world of alternative facts and lived experience, is we actually do just end up in a society of double plus ungood. And younger listeners are probably going, what, double plus ungood? What's that? Oh God. You know, the fact that that's not a reference anymore. You know, we talk about the Thanos snap instead, that somebody can just snap their fingers and make, you know, make half the population disappear. Now, I think it's telling that, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is now dealing with some aspects of what happens when half the population came back, you know, like they're actually dealing with that now. Yay. Happy ending in Infinity War. One of the most unpopular video I did on YouTube ever was me pushing back against the whole Thanos thing and arguing that Iron Man defeated Thanos's genocide with a genocide of his own. He didn't wipe out half of Thanos's armies. He wiped out all of Thanos's armies with a snap of his finger. And you're supposed to assume that he just did that because Thanos's army was bad. Right. And I compared that to the ending of Game of Thrones, where everybody was so unhappy that Daenerys Targaryen, you know, dragon singed an entire city, which to me is where they were going from the beginning. She started there. You know, she hung people up on, she essentially crucified people at the side of the road as she went through. But in like season two of Game of Thrones, you didn't see that, you know, torture and murder from the point of view of the people who were being tortured and murdered. And in the last season of Game of Thrones, you did. There was all this perspective of, you know, Arya Stark running through the streets with terrified, you know, terrified civilians. It's all just perspective. But killing, you know, kill mass murder to make your point is mass murder, no matter who you do it to. And if it is just unpopular to say that, we have a problem. Because it's okay when we do it is what creates these shifting boundaries of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. But people were so caught up in the emotional retirement of Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, they didn't want, you know, they didn't want questions getting in the way of their emotional journey. And I'm like, that's a bit scary. Of course, in good Marvel tradition, they spend a very long time cleaning up the big visual spectacle they did in one of their big Avengers movies, right? Like the one before this was Ultron, just, you know, using the city of Sokovia as a projectile.
Yeah.
And oh, cool visual, but oh man, that's like a war crime and shit.
Yeah.
And like, you know, the Avengers got blamed for it, and that's sort of like a realistic, you know what? The problem is everybody sees this stuff after the fact, but at the time they're like, yeah, good guys win, right? And it's like, can we just tell cool morality plays where it's just sort of about the story instead of having to make something so big that we can't conceive of it anymore? The X-Men Apocalypse, that was my issue with that movie, is they had the whole thing of, you know, oh, it's all around the world, you know, it's he's so powerful, he's disrupting the whole world with something, which ironically was also the beginning of Zack Snyder's Justice League. But to me, that is so big. You can't make a story about something that big it no longer becomes a story about people with faces and individual personalities that you care about. It becomes a statistic.
Yeah. Huh?
I don't think that's good storytelling. That is what an 8-year-old does. I am the most strong, powerful, right? Which is fine when you're 8, right? Like, fine. Yes. But adults shouldn't be making media for other adults that's still there. You know what I mean? And the stupid thing is the cynical reasons for that. It's because they have to do things with as few words as possible so that they can export this stuff, you know, around the world. And you can't tell stories about good and evil anymore because the Chinese government's going to get upset. Right? Because our idea of good tends to be individualistic, though that's waning. That's a no-no in you know, for the Chinese Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell, man? Like, this isn't storytelling anymore. This is just, and I meant to bring this up earlier. So I'll bring it up now. That was a Yogi Berra-ism. But unfortunately, Terry Pratchett's idea of stories didn't win out in the war of ideas. Richard Dawkins' idea of memes won out. Uh-huh. And I think that's part of the problem, because the idea of a meme kind of opens the door to sophistry, right?
Yes.
Because a meme is basically the idea that little, small, short ideas, behaviors that spread essentially by imitation have some kind of inherent symbolic meaning. That's ripe for abuse, uh-huh. Right? That's ripe for abuse, that taking the idea of, you know, mimetics and insisting that memes have inherent value as opposed to simply being semiotics. I think that's a real error in thinking that's caught on. For some odd reason, Richard Dawkins got great man status, and people stopped questioning the idea that, no, if a human produces it, it is essentially, you know, if a human produces something through language, which symbolism is a form of language, then it is by definition metaphorical, mm-hmm. Right?
Oops.
Oh, so I you didn't hit your mute button. I was better at coughing.
I was not fast enough.
See, you actually coughed just there, right? Like, that was not a metaphor of a cough. That was not Plato's idea of a chair. That was a cough. You know, the absolute unit, right? Instead of that being the modern day version of a Yogi Berra-ism, we're supposed to believe now that memes have inherent meaning. And that's how you get the poor creator of Pepe the Frog having completely losing control of his own character, having to bow to the fact that that character is inherently an alt-right symbol, and he can't use the character he created anymore because somebody else determined for him what it meant.
Yeah, poor guy.
That's so bad for him. I feel bad for him too, but that's seriously disturbing.
Oh yeah.
You know, that authorial intents are so meaningless now. And it's anti-critical thinking too. It's not just anti-expression. It's anti-critical thinking, because we talk about floating abstractions all the time. But think about it. If people can just chain a bunch of unrelated, not even thoughts, just pictures, you know, just ironic images meant to convey something, nobody's quite sure what it is, you have to sort of understand meaning through context. Well, you can't have logic, formal or otherwise, under those settings.
Yeah, that's how you end up with for crying out loud, that episode, Star Trek.
Oh, Darmok
and Tanagra.
Yeah. And you know, on the one hand, that was just a means of communication, right? For people who don't know what the Darmok episode is, it's the episode of Star Trek Next Generation where Picard ends up on a planet and meets an alien where the universal translator fails because this species speaks in metaphors based on cultural myths that the universal translator does not have knowledge of. So it's all references. Like if you don't know who Yogi Berra is, when I say it's a Yogi Berraism, they're like, what? That bear from Hey Hey Boo Boo, right? Like, you know, when we start singing, if you don't know the musical, you're lost.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine an entire episode where people are talking about that and they end up finding a commonality of myth through Gilgamesh and an approximation as such, and they end up being able to work together and communicate through that. But these are two people that actually wanted to communicate, not just make noises in other people's direction, right? And, and this is the problem. It doesn't seem that people want to communicate ideas, right? The idea of formal logic to me, and this is what frustrates me about the way it's used, is that the idea of formal logic is to basically create some ground rules so we can actually get somewhere, please, instead of just spinning in circles, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and Ben Shapiro is quite bad for this. I shouldn't say that. Ben Shapiro is better at this than people like Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson is just, I'm going to yell a lot of words so people give me money. Shapiro's different because he has to get around the fact that, you know, before the internet, nobody would have let somebody with a voice like his in front of a camera. That's not me judging him. That is just so, right? But he has this ability to create the appearance of formal logic, but no, it is very much not. He starts from just such flawed first principles that it doesn't matter how good everything else he says is. Now, he commits a lot of fallacies along the way, but it sounds good, right? His sophistry is more sophisticated than Tucker Carlson's just bleating on television every night. You know, Tucker Carlson has descended into absolute racism. He probably already was there. It's just so obvious now that we can't say, well, that's just his opinion anymore. And that's my real concern, Mouse. And maybe I'm overreacting. I'm prepared to hear that I'm overreacting on this. That implies that I'm not prepared to hear I'm overreacting on anything else. That's not so. But especially on this one, this is not a hill I'm going to die on. But the sophistry of the arguments surrounding things like cancel culture and labeling everything a Nazi and, you know, the fight over Dr. Seuss, which just, oh dear Lord, like this is all just sophistry. My concern is that sophistry is designed to maintain status quo. I mean, that's what it is, right? Like, you want to keep the sons of nobility noble, therefore teach them how to fight dirty, right? In the blanking on the name, Parsegoria, you know, teach them how to get by in this heavily constructed, quote unquote, civilized world. There was no real interest in really changing things. The idea was to just keep the powerful powerful.
Yeah.
And when you indulge in sophistry, even if you think you have a progressive cause, by its very nature, sophistry maintains status quo. So if you are a progressive and going out there and engaging in sophist arguments, like we want to abolish the police and put in a community safety force, that's just police by another name, right? Mm-hmm. If you do that, you are engaging in an exercise of maintaining status quo. You're just changing the name. You're not really changing anything. You're not getting into the underlying factors of, no, no, we need complete ground up rethink of how over-policed neighborhoods are handled with schools, with healthcare, with home ownership, with access to business capital, everything. Focusing on this sophist argument about we're going to replace the police with something that does pretty much the basic functions of the police, but we're going to call it something else. You are taking your eye off the ball and you're going to get nothing done because you're going to spend all your time arguing about what words mean. And that's what really has me concerned, Mouse, because so many things on so many issues like immigration, not just in the US, around the world, combined with climate change, we're going to have a lot of displaced people, right? We need to do something about climate change, but we took too long. So we're going to have to deal with mass migrations of people. We're going to have to figure out a way to make it work. We can't wait anymore, right? Healthcare, same thing. With climate change, we're going to end up with a lot more really weird diseases, and we can't, you know, we can't solve every single one of these with a 2-year friggin' quarantine that they don't want to call a quarantine. It's physical distancing. Fuck off. It's a quarantine. You know, people, is it a quarantine? Is it not a quarantine? No, it's opt-in. No, it's not, because you fine people for not doing it. It's a friggin' quarantine, right? Like, we have to solve these problems, and sophistry will not do it. And the thing that makes me so concerned is we have an entire two entire generations, because now we have the millennials and Gen Z. We have two educated intellectual classes that are essentially dyed-in-the-wool sophists. And, you know, we need to just clone Pete Buttigieg, because without guys like him, we are fucked. You know, we are that. I know that isn't a very sophisticated thing, but sometimes you just have to be blunt. Like, you need guys like him who can go up there. And he's a, like, there's an example of a guy. He's excellent at rhetoric. Like, oh, man, the things, you know, he came up with that off the cuff, or at least had that prepared in his back pocket, because he didn't know what question Fox News was going to ask. But bam, you know, he actually answered it and he schooled them. He's very good at rhetoric, but he's not a sophist. He dips his toe in it occasionally, but at the end of the day, his arguments are actually based in reason, right? For instance, this whole thing about opposing eliminating college debt, because as he pointed out, you know, like, okay, you wipe out my college debt. Well, college debt starts for the person who enters school tomorrow. We're not solving the problem. Fair point, right? It's similar to your views on the minimum wage, right? It's not actually solving the problem. It's just making us feel like we're solving the problem.
Yeah, it's a feel-good solution.
Yeah, I mean, instead of recognizing that, hey, gee, maybe we shouldn't be consolidating industries that don't need to be shoved in together, like tech, maybe we shouldn't be consolidating that in major cities. You know, maybe we should be spreading things around so we get places like, you know, the Kitchener-Waterloo region in Ontario, which Kitchener-Waterloo was really nothing. It was best known for Oktoberfest before BlackBerry went in there. And this idea that, oh, no, we need a major city where transit is accessible and all that stuff. It's like, guys, if you see how Kitchener works, people have houses that are closer to BlackBerry than you can park at Google, right? Like, Google's parking lot is so big, they need a bus line. But, hey, they have the bus, right? It's you're closer to your work there than you are at this big amassing of people, right? Maybe we need to spread the wealth out that way through functioning in support of capitalism, as opposed to this weird corporate consolidation that doesn't really do anything but amass. You know, I've noticed guys like Jeff Bezos, guys like Mark Zuckerberg, no matter where they start, they end up like Maxwell Lord. The answer is always more. Right? No, the answer is not always more. after a while, money is an abstraction. A guy like Zuckerberg, a guy like Bezos is has more money than they and probably about seven generations of their families will ever need. And that's basically living like Saudi princes, right? So why are they so obsessed with more and more and more? It's either identity or meaning at that point. And if guys like that can't find a meaning to their existence, what the hell is going on? Like, what is going on? It's just like people are really bored now and don't know what to do about it. They so lack purpose, you know? And I know I'm sounding self-helpy there with the whole being on purpose, but I really think there is something to it. I mean, that's another thing Terry Pratchett nailed. A lot of his ongoing kind of gadfly characters, sacrifice likability for purpose. Granny Weatherwax certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, even the younger characters, what was her name? The woman who inherited all Granny Weatherwax, Tabitha.
Oh, for crying out, Tiffany Aching.
Tiffany, that's right. It's an interesting, very fluffy name. But you know, the girl, you know, that was the last book, right? Where she sort of
the Shepherd's Crown. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the last book that she sort of inherited that. That was sort of a story about her finding purpose, which is why the fact she has a fluffy name that I can't remember is so apt. Right. Terry Pratchett's a really good storyteller as opposed to, I think there's a difference between being a good storyteller and being schooled in rhetoric. Right. Because a storyteller doesn't really care if they persuade you. They just want to take you along on the journey. And I remember what I was going to say now about your comment about stories. I think, and maybe this can sort of be our final point that we drill down on. And I hesitated saying this because I was afraid I was committing sophistry with this and mulling it over. No, it is different. The issue is not that everybody wants to be a storyteller now, or everybody is sort of a self-deluded storyteller. The problem is that we don't value storytellers anymore. We want essayists, right? We want people to make a point in their writing, as opposed to just, you know, write a story about a couple of people sailing down the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
You know, letting the interesting thing about Mark Twain, especially, is I realize how much he just lets the reader come to their own conclusions. He doesn't pound the table. And a lot of writing from that period was like that. I think because they lived in a similar age where everything was very tense and you had to be really careful what you said, because you didn't really know if somebody was a Confederate, a Unionist, you know, in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
But Mark Twain was an excellent, excellent storyteller. He had a wisdom similar to Terry Pratchett. I think Terry Pratchett was a somewhat better wordsmith than Mark Twain was. But that might be a matter of subjective opinion. But it's not like, what the hell's his name? The guy who wrote Wicked.
Oh God, Gregory Maguire.
Gregory Maguire.
I think that's his name.
Yeah, I think you're right. That guy wanted to be an essayist so badly, and instead he wrote a work of fiction. And you're seeing that a lot, you know, like these things where Thanos makes a big speech, right? Somebody else makes a big speech. People don't see stuff unless the character stops all the action and tells the audience, it's the Iago, I am a villain speech in Othello, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's that big I am song in something that's not a musical, people either insist it's not there or people try to fight for a definitive interpretation. I saw a think piece about how Falcon and the Winter Soldier didn't focus enough on Sam Wilson's blackness. And it was another one where I'm like, did we watch the same show? Because that's hardwired into it, just because he doesn't sit there and make some big, you know, we're canceling the apocalypse speech. Does it bless Idris Elba? He did that so well. But just because that's not there doesn't mean people can't see that in a work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because there isn't some big declarative statement doesn't mean that's not a theme. And now I'm just getting sort of nauseated thinking about what it's like to discuss Alan Moore's Watchmen online now.
Oh, Lord.
Because people...
Why don't.
There's a shiny... Okay, Mouse, have you found this too, that people think that Watchmen is about one point of view, or these guys are right and these guys are wrong, when the whole thing that makes Watchmen really good is because it defies such simple characterization?
Yes.
You know, like Rorschach's right sometime, Night Owl's right sometimes, Ozymandias is even right sometimes, but they're all profoundly corrupt people in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And just because Rorschach is more sacrificial in his own personal form of corruption, and even though you could argue that Rorschach is probably more mentally ill and traumatized than anything, his moral systems are still like, what? He does some pretty awful things in the name of morality, right? He's just not as successful at it as some of the others. And so he's seen as the everyman, and some people assign nobility to him that's not there.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the fault of the work. That's the fault of people wanting works of fiction to be the essays we have to write about works of fiction, right? Nobody gets a college degree because they wrote a book. They get college degrees by writing essay after essay. Right. They write essays about books. And so then they go to try to write a book and they end up writing an essay. And then they go, the world's not fair. Why won't you take my essay masquerading as a book? And it's not their fault. We've talked about the problems of the education system, but we really need to shed this sophistry so we can get back to an examination of truth. And that's, Mouse, I'm really surprised you said that stories aren't real because life is messy. And I think the best stories deal with the inherent messiness of life, like Watchmen, like some of the things that Terry Pratchett does, like, you know, Mark Twain did in his very, very gentle way. I just watched the movie News of the World, Tom mm-hmm. Hanks movie. So it's automatically comforting. But talk about a story. And this is why I say, you know, good stories talk about messiness. The structure of the story is very simple. Tom Hanks's character has to take a little girl from point A to point B, you know, braving dangers along the way. But they deal with the fact that he was a Confederate surrender, now reading Union news in the former Confederate territories, Texas, New Mexico, and so on. But then he's got a little girl who only speaks Kiowa, an indigenous language, because she was a German immigrant whose parents were killed by American indigenous people, but then her adoptive indigenous people were killed. And, you know, there's a hint that his wife was, you know, Hispanic and this and that. And there's all this mess backgrounding this really simple story of going from point A to point B and the things that happen along the way.
Well, the reason I said life is messy, it's not that there are not messy elements. It's what I meant is that people's lives don't conveniently arrange themselves into an easy narrative.
Oh, I see. Life doesn't have chapters.
Mm-hmm. And life doesn't really have a narrative. You know, you win the contest, and in a movie or in a book, you know, that is where it ends. But you don't. And the reason why books are good, a book reads well, is because it ends where it needs to end and it starts where it needs to start, usually in medias res.
Well, except for Lord of the Rings. That sucker just goes on and on and on and on and on. But I concede your point. I get what you're saying.
Well, there's a reason why people made jokes about Lord of the Rings being split into six movies, the last three happening in the credits.
It's true. And that became something people keep doing instead of recognizing that that was a tick.
Yeah.
I mean, the Snyder Cut did the same thing. Holy shit. That thing just kept going. it's like, all right, good ending. We have our why is there 20 minutes more movie? And people say, because that was the point. I'm like, you know what? Even though it confused me, can I say they're wrong? Like, okay, if the point was just to put everything he shot on screen, all right, that's the exercise. Right?
It sounds to me like the Snyder Cut should have been renamed Proud Mary.
Maybe, I don't know. I just think it's when one guy screws up so bad that the guy who screwed up before him seems like less of a screw up. That to me is the moral of the Snyder Cut, because there was a good movie in there
somewhere.
And I do think, Mouse, you're right that stories exist to provide structure to the world. I think that in an increasingly complex, or at least in increasing awareness of the complexity of the world was always complex. We were just aware of less of that at a given time. We do need stories to make that make sense for us, but we need people to tell those stories who are actually interested in facts and truth, not just sophists playing to the crowd, right?
Well, we need to also remember that there are stories, and that stories, we tell stories to focus a point. We right. tell stories to highlight something. We tell stories to figure out where we are. But just because one story has one protagonist, it doesn't mean that there are not other protagonists involved in their own stories. It doesn't mean that that is the only scope that there is.
Well,
is something that we have to remember.
I also think too many people feel nowadays like secondary characters in their own life. And that is a problem. But I think that in terms of getting people to all row in the same direction, stories are super powerful, right? I mean, right. Part of the reason COVID-19 got so fucked up is they call it the messaging, but what they really screwed up was the story they told the public about stuff, right? They went for this, you know, World War II patriotism redux. When that doesn't work anymore, it really should have been, tell them you're going to do it, tell them you did it, right? Like, the big mistake our premier made is it should have been, you know, ICUs hit 300 people, we shut down. So if you don't want that, guys, don't get sick. You know, simple cause and effect. You hit 300 people, we're shutting down. Our hospitals are overwhelmed. We can't do that because if somebody gets in a car accident, we need to be able to treat them. Fine. You know it's coming. That's fair. This wishy-washy, I'll do it. You know, the old man yells at cloud shit that Doug Ford's been doing. It's a far less effective story. And now there's really no leadership in the whole thing, because various levels of political alleged leadership couldn't stop fighting long enough to get done, because the fight is their narrative, right? So stories have power. Stories, I come down on the side of Terry Pratchett that stories do have an element of realness to them, provided the facts of the story are actually accurate. Because let's face it, a story that's not factual is just a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that case isn't sophistry. It's no longer a story if you're not telling the truth. You're lying. And that's a very different thing. And I think too many people use stories to try to force life to conform to what they'd like it to be, instead of telling stories of life as it is. And obviously that's a matter of subjective opinion. We could fight forever about what life is and what life isn't and what it all means. But I do think there is there is a way to judge. Like, to end sophistry, we must agree that there actually is objective reality, and we get to Ayn Rand right at the end. Right. Yeah, right. In order for there to be truth, there must be objective reality. In terms of, if for there to be objective reality, it must not be just perception. There must be some things that are and some things that are not. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And stories are basically exercises in rational selfishness. They're trying to get people to do the right things because it feels good. That's how I sort of see them. That is a very delicate balance, and it falls apart when the stories no longer are trying to get people to do the right thing. Right. And that's the problem with people like Ben Shapiro, Tucker Carlson, you know, Ted Cruz, people like that. They know. Josh Hawley knows, you know, they know the mm-hmm. election wasn't fixed. People are talking from behind the scenes at Fox News. People there know the election wasn't fixed. They're lying to people, mm-hmm. right? So, and that's, you know, that's why it's important to understand concepts like sophistry, because just because something, I don't know about you, Mouse, we'll land here. Whenever something gives me sort of a, yeah, you know, applause line now, I have a moment and go, wait a minute. Does this actually make sense? And sometimes I get so distracted trying to figure out if that makes sense, I actually miss what comes next
A
given piece, because I'm sitting here going, did somebody just feed me a load of bull that I just accepted because it's my brand of bull? Or does this actually make sense? And I'm actually finding more and more and more that exercise has caused me to question a lot of my own truisms about, does this actually work? You know,
mm-hmm.
which is a great way to go crazy. But you know, if there's no objective truth, and there's no such thing as crazy, right? Like,
right.
We're all mad here. Lewis Carroll was a mathematician, bless him. All right. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network, funetwork.tv, PayPal, Patreon, you know the drill. Mouse, as usual, you have the final word.
I actually have an appropriate quote from Sir Terry himself on this.
Hey.
I wrote that in the days when I thought fantasy was old battles and kings. Now I'm inclined to think that the real concerns of fantasy ought to be about not having battles and doing away with kings.